Welcome back to another episode of the Business Beyond Performance podcast. I am Joe Staub here with the luscious co-host, Matt Powell.
Thanks so much, brother. I appreciate it. Kind words from a kind man.
Yeah, no problem. You know, again, high tide rises all boats, and your boat otherwise would be at the bottom. So I got to keep it going up.
Oh, man. That was a good one. That was solid.
So tonight we have Mike Baskier. Okay. Strength coach. I know I got the last name right. We had to check. I had to make sure. I didn't want to mess it up. I messed it up all the time. I'm terrible with names. Strength and conditioning coach for about 20 years who got out. And as a guy who I've known now for just a handful of years, you know, we have some, you know, again, the way the business works, we had some connections, we knew some people, but have got to know him really well and actually spent time talking to him, meeting him in person at conferences. And he was a guy who I kind of resonated with because much like me, he had young kids and that was his number one. So he had the opportunity to get out of the business and is now in a totally other world, but also has some background doing some, you know, home remodeling, some other stuff, kind of like you, Matt. So it was a great conversation with a guy who, you know, again, taking that cross section of people we have. He is at a different level. You know, he's not Fergus Conley, and he's not some of our other guests who are CEOs. He's a guy who is a coach. He did some things in business, and he also transitioned out of coaching into a different part of business to kind of align his values with his actions in just a different way. And for him, that was family.
Yeah, Mike does a fantastic job of putting everything together, taking all the lessons learned from his coaching experience and being able to be successful as a contracting purchase agent, basically, where he goes out and he finds the correct people for right positions and tries to bid on contracts that the DOD is selling. So touches into my world a little bit, obviously at a different level in a different way, but somebody who was able to be successful, like we talk about so many times, because of soft skills and because of his ability to create connections and create jumps into these other components of his life. This does not define you just being in this profession or being in this realm. You should learn how to do different things and grow from that. That's how the long-term success comes.
No, well said, Matt. And again, if for those of you just joining us tonight, we always recommend go back to episode zero, just so you kind of understand where me and Matt are coming from, not only in all of this, but kind of in every episode as well. So without any more delay, episode 7, Mike Baskier. All right, here tonight with Mike Basinger. Even though there's no N in your name, I put an N in your name. It's in my phone with an N. Sorry, you're just Basinger. Just is what it is. And former strength coach. So multiple stops, about 20 years in the service. Indiana, JMU, Auburn. Where else were you at? Illinois.
Ohio University.
Ohio. Well. And a funny story. So my guy went to Illinois with you, and then you left, and then someone else I know went to Illinois, and then they left, and now Jay, it's just the, as we mentioned before this, the way strength and conditioning work. Also, interesting experience in the private setting at a Velocity, so understanding the business of performance. And then, one thing many may not know, competitive Olympic and powerlifter at one point in his day.
A couple pounds ago. But yeah, I used to be kind of good, but not anymore. Washed up.
Is that like the whole, like, I'm as good as I once was once kind of deal?
A little Toby Keith, I think. Yeah, for sure. Yep. I'm not as good as I once was, but I'm as good once as I ever was. However, I'm not even as good once as I ever was. So it's all right.
Well, thank you for joining us. So the real question is, and I don't think I've ever asked you, how do you actually pronounce your last name?
Bass gear. Bass like a fish, gear like a car. Or if you're going bass fishing, you got to bring your bass gear.
All right. See, I thought you were Basinger with an N, because that's what I had you in my phone as.
Most people do. Nah, it's bass gear. Super German, super ugly and simple, not French or anything else. So if you want to like hawk in the middle of it and give it a bell, it's probably... probably right. So
nice. All right, I'm not even gonna try because I'll screw it up. So
fair.
But no, thanks for coming on, thanks for taking the time. Obviously, as another guy who's got a family with kids, relatively young kids, you know, they're not babies anymore, but appreciate you making the time. Obviously, we're doing these all at night so we can fit them in amongst all our other responsibilities of our day jobs and our family lives. So that's kind of the first question. Is I started with, you were a strength coach and you had about 20 years in. What do you do now? Who is Mike?
Mike is a happy retired strength coach is who Mike is. About a year ago, I transitioned out, and I'm working in government contracting now for what's called an SDVOSB. So that's a service disabled veteran owned small business. It's a mouthful, but it's actually a really big deal. If your small business can get that designation, which the company I work for does, you get essentially preferential access to the government's pipeline, because they're often looking to funnel business to companies that have that designation. It's a way to help military veterans. So it's a great company, great cause. And, about 98% of our pipeline is dedicated to Veterans Affairs. So I started out in the business development area, market research, contract research, and I've transitioned into capture analysis, which is a fancy way of saying selling to the government. So that's where we are now.
So what led you to transition from strength and conditioning into what you do now, and kind of how did you make that jump?
I almost got out probably 16 or 17 times, right? And I stayed in for all the reasons that you get in the first place. I stayed in because I love the kids. I love the grind. I love being in a weight room. Loved game day, right? So all the stuff that we know and love. But it became unsustainable. It was interesting. Last midsummer of 2019. So we are, we're October, almost November of 2020 right now. So a little over a year ago, I began what I have termed my survey of the next step. And, that was calling a bunch of buddies that had nothing to do with collegiate athletics. And I'm getting on the phone. What do you do? Because we get in that bubble, right? That coaching bubble. We don't know what the heck's going on outside of collegiate athletics. So calling, either pure luck or smart or whatever, I kept friends outside of the industry. Thank goodness. Right. So I probably talked to 10 or 15 people. What do you do? How'd you get there? Could I do that? Brutal honesty, would I be able to do that? And some people said no, which is great. That gives you direction. And the plan summer of 19 was to do a 2-year survey and sort of slow cook the decision and get out sometime in 21. That was the plan. Something fell into my lap working for a buddy of 25 years. He's the owner of this company. So obviously a personal connection was huge there. Successful firm, really good friend, actually a family values driven company, not just lip service as maybe we get in collegiate athletics sometimes. Yeah. And that was the transition aspect of the whole thing. It was going to be 2 years. It ended up being 2 months. So a little nudge from my buddy. He said, "Hey, I get it. You might not be ready to get out, but if something falls into your lap, don't be an idiot." So
one of the things you mentioned that I want to definitely bring up, because it's a question we ask everybody, is that, who are the people around you that kind of shape your decisions and kind of help you go in the direction you want to go?
Oh, you're reading my mind, Paul. You're reading my mind.
As he shows off his fancy rocket book.
Hey, Rocket Book, in case you're listening, Rocket Book, one day, love him. Love it. Boston-based company. Love it.
Shameless plug. Here we go.
So one of the things we ask people a lot is the people who shape you and why you chose those people. Like, I know I have a few people outside the industry that are probably even more important to me than people inside the industry, because they keep me grounded or they give me an outside aspect, an outside look that I don't usually have. So how did you decide who your people are and why those people?
Well, the top three people I've got to answer to are my wife and my two boys. So my boys were too young. You know, if they were teenagers, they could probably offer an opinion on the decision, but they're too young to really speak on it. So my wife, without overstating it, happily gave the stamp of approval on the transition. Outside of that, I've got probably a group of four to five people that are like, that's my entourage, you know, the circle of trust, if I can put it sort of in a corny way. And I talked to those guys, and the consistent response was, dude, we have this conversation every 3 years, and now you have a golden opportunity. So I think you might already know the answer. You just haven't stepped up and given it to yourself yet. So these are, you know, four to five buddies, lifelong, you know, 30 to 35 years I've known them. So, yeah. And to your point, all of them are not, they're non-coaches, not involved in athletics at all. I got a pharmacist, two guys in law enforcement, and an attorney. So that's the beginning to a terrible joke, but.
That's awesome. The other question I want to go into was, as you kind of made that transition, what was the most difficult part getting out of coaching? And, you know, obviously we know what drove you, right? You wanted more time with your family, and I'll let you kind of get into that. But what was the hardest part about the transition out?
I mean, the hardest part is how much of that industry is a part of our identity, right? Like, you know, not to put a gender spin on it, but there's some research that suggests that men are more defined by their careers than women. I hope that doesn't offend anybody. There is some literature surrounding that, and you know, as men, that's who we are. So there was, you know, the phrase I like to use, been kind of tossing this out there for years, you know, throwing the former self on the fire and just let it burn and you know, see what comes anew from the fire, right? So walking away from that sense of identity, walking away from that ego fulfillment, right? Walking away from what you know. I mean, you know, the grind and the hours away from the family suck sometimes, but at least you know what it is, right? So
100%. So I want to hit on your survey, the next step. You talked about, and again, this is something I've referenced to a lot of people. I failed for years to be successful where I am now because I knew I wasn't just going to magically have something when I got out, right? I expected to apply and not get interviews. I expected to interview and not be qualified. I expected to have to learn and earn my stripes and take steps back to go forward. So I did that while I coached, in order to get to the point where I could make what seems, and people have said it to me, you made seamless transition. No, I did a lot of extra to make that look that way. So Right. You said survey the next step, and you gave yourself 2 years, right? You had, it, like you said, it fell into your lap, the right connection, the right dynamics.
Yep.
But say it didn't. What was your plan in those 2 years from a skill development, from a path of learning? What did you think you were going to do in that time period to be ready?
Well, the short answer is I never got a chance to find out. I did have a phased approach, and phase one was talk to people, survey, see what's out there. And I wasn't going to be prepared to formulate phase two until that was done. To touch on the other part of your question, I thought I was going to end up doing something with young people in some capacity. I was prepared to look into teaching junior college, community college, coaching high school, something along those lines, which are all, I may still do that. You know, those are all noble pursuits in my opinion. But I thought the most applicable transition for me would be, hey, I've been a coach for 20 years working with young people. It makes sense that I would do something similar. Mm-hmm. So.
Nice. All right. So now let me flip it on you and go the other way. Because you had the opportunity, you had to jump in. What did you leverage from coaching that allowed you to be successful? Because, and again, fill in some blanks. Did you have the business background? Were you strong with your financial acumen? Did you, you know, are you that we talk about all the time? I'm the CFO of the Staub House. Powell's the CFO of the Powell House, right? Are you the CFO of your house, or did you have to learn that stuff to be where you are?
I'm 100% the CFO of my house. I had some real estate ventures on the side while I was coaching. Powell, I dumped all those. So sorry, we can't go into business on that. But I did run that venture. And Joe, I do want to touch on, I appreciate your point and your candor about your failures, right, to get to where you are. My failures came after I got hired, because my buddy and I had a very, it was a great conversation. He said, "You're taking a massive leap of faith here." He's like, "You essentially know nothing about this industry. You don't know anything about the company. You do not have a degree in business. And I want you to understand, as a friend and as the owner of the company, how big of a leap this is." And he was right. So my failures came in the first 6 months of essentially being dropped off on another planet. So you, my friend, are not the only one that experienced failure. It was humbling going from being a head strength coach to being essentially on the ground floor, right? So we got sidetracked there. What was your next question? I wanted to make sure I hit on that.
No, right? So, and again, just for anyone listening, I say failure, everyone thinks it's a bad thing. To me, it's one, it's part of the process, and two, like, I kind of knew I was going to fail. Like, I had to do it to fail, to learn, to get better. So again, I come at it from just, if people heard me and said I failed, I wasn't beating myself up over it. I was saying, right, I'm going to take this to do more. So just to context thing. No, to your point, so you fail in those first 6 months. What did you fall back on? Was it the hustle? Was it the intensity? Was it, you know, you can learn fast? Was it people skills? What got you over that hump when you were getting kicked in the ass?
A lot of it was the knowledge that I was going to get kicked in the ass for 6 months, and being able to step back, because listen, we're hard charging. We're inherently aggressive, right? As coaches, we're probably type A, not judging. So being able to mute a lot of that inherent personality that we as coaches have, and understanding that it was going to be a rough first 6 months, and contextualizing what that time period was going to be, enabled me to kind of work through it. And I was really hoping we could get through the whole talk without any of us making a training reference, but we're 15 minutes in and I got to make the training reference here. It was the first,
seal, man, you broke the seal.
I know. It was the soreness after the first couple of weeks. You know, you're going to be sore. You come up for air, you recover. Sorry, boys, had to do it. So that you know, you're asking what knowledge base do you fall back on, right? Well, so
given you didn't have the industry skills and you hadn't had the time, right, to learn business, to do, you know, you had a little background in real estate and finance management, which we want to get into, but, you know, you plowed through because you relied on skills you had. So which one and how did you do it?
I think the people skills and the ability to communicate with coaches and administrators in collegiate athletics is arguably unparalleled. So you have to sharpen a serious axe to be able to survive for any length of time in that industry, and you've got to sharpen your communication skills. Your ability to listen and sift through what the real facts are. So, you know, we talk about failures. I mean, the times that I failed in communication with an administrator or with a sport coach and coming out better from all that, I leaned on that a lot. And Joe, I think I shared with you last week. I mean, not to jinx the process here, but I don't know if there's a whole lot that can rattle us after spending X number of years as a strength and conditioning coach in terms of, you know, what you see and what you have to deal with. Right.
Yeah. What I always joke, like, again, I have a degree, I have a certification in HR and all this other stuff that I've accomplished. Right. And in one of the conferences HR related, I went to, you know, you have everyone from Pam, the HR, the stereotypical, no offense, if there's any Pam HRs out there, but you know, and I was looking at them, listening to them talking, and I was like, wow, I'm like, you guys need to come do what I do for a living, because you want to see what's not supposed to happen. And like, literally is a lawsuit every day. It's just
covered every day.
It's literally covered up. And again, that's a whole other conversation, but
sure. Yeah,
no, like the stuff I've seen dealt and had put in front of me and my feet to the fire. Whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the other thing that plays into this that I think is extremely relevant is the preservation of energy, as I call it. You are, as an individual, you're sharper, better, quicker on your feet, and can make better decisions when you're working 40 to 45 hours a week instead of 70. That's just part of human nature. So, you know, I've noticed it. Not to overshare, but I've noticed an increase in just my personal health, feeling better, more energy. There's probably some strength coaches out there who will toughen up, but hey, man, I get it. I know why you feel that way, but you know, go read your Matthew Walker PhD book on why we sleep, and then you might understand what I'm getting at. So. Just the shift in demand and the change in schedule alone, I think, has improved my people skills.
Are you guys trying to say your athletic administration and sport coaches weren't amazing? Because those are the only things that I had for my time in college and now tactical and everything else. And it's been smooth sailing, guys. So clearly you guys really just do need to toughen up.
I'm on it. Send me a program. I'll work on it.
So I actually say this to people who deal with that, what me and Mike just described, I say, look, that's why you need to keep moving. And the industry, again, the industry is what it is, where people shift and whatever. It's not the every year shift or the every 6 month shift. It's get to a certain point in your career, evolve yourself if you're not being evolved where you are, and realize that what you see, and Mike, you said earlier, the blinders you have on may just be where you're at. You know, I know one particular person who I worked with previously is in this situation, and she's not only got the blinders on a little bit, but what's around her is narrow. So, you know, I always tell her, I'm like, look, if you got another gig somewhere else with better administrators, with better leadership, with more resources, and that's not bigger weight room, nicer toys, more resources to develop you as a person, you might find your passion for the industry again, because your tunnel has blackened you to what's around because it's given you tunnel vision.
That's great. Yeah.
I think we've all been at smaller schools, FCS level schools, and we understand what it's like to actually build a program, take something with an extremely small budget and make the best out of you possibly can. Was it always great? I can tell you from my experience, at least it wasn't. There were times that I screwed things up for sure. We talked about failures earlier. I know I had a few, especially learning as a head strength coach for the first time. But we had interns who would go to these major SEC, NFL, MLB. You know, I sent interns everywhere because I worked my butt off to try to get them every opportunity I possibly could. And every time they come back, they'd be like, they weren't this amazing thing. I didn't learn this sudden magic, you know, trick or something like that. And it's just, I think that proves kind of where this is, you know. It's not about teaching you something special that nobody else knows. It's about teaching the basics and giving you awesome human skills to go out and be a better coach and a better person.
Amen to that.
Yeah.
So anyways, moving on.
I'll that rabbit hole for a long time.
Yeah.
I'll piggyback one thing off of that, Matt, because you jogged my memory on that one. I went to a conference, a basketball specific conference at Hammer Strength put it on at Villanova. Lon Record put it on. Heck, it's been a decade now. But I saw the single best strength and conditioning presentation I've ever seen was at that conference, and it was by a high school strength coach. So doesn't matter where you are or what you're working with, like, this guy had a heck of a message on many levels. So it's a great point.
I appreciate that. One of the best things I've ever heard too is at that same school, I was ticked off. You know, I spent a little bit of time in the NFL and wanted to get back. Thought it was going to be an easy route. Damn, I was wrong. I was working at that same job that I was talking about before, where I was at the FCS level. And one of the guys said, don't worry about going to the big time. All I want to do is go to the NFL. Don't worry about going to the big time. Worry about making where you are big time. And that always kind of just stuck with me.
That's great.
That's the stuff I think people miss, especially, I mean, I think we can all say it, and not to, again, just because you have a big salary in the world of strength and conditioning doesn't mean you're good at strength and conditioning. In a lot of cases, it means you're good at playing the Game of Thrones, not necessarily training kids.
And to that point, yeah, that's 1,000% correct. And a couple things to piggyback off of that, you know, if you're at the big time place, you've got a lot of pick of the litter athletes that are going to make you look really good. And I had the pleasure of meeting an individual who's a strength coach at for quite a while at one of the major football programs. And this person shared with me the incredible salary that they were making and said, I was making this and I was absolutely miserable. So that's, you know, that's an important thing to consider for people that are going to be watching this as well, for our viewers. So.
For sure. And so you've already talked about kind of the ego standpoint. You've talked about how you kind of had a plan to get out. Can you go into what you were doing for a side hustle while you were the head strength coach of these different locations, or an assistant strength coach?
The only time I was really able to leverage a true side hustle was the 4 years that I was an assistant at Indiana. Tom Morris, who's the AD of sports performance at Indiana now, a very, very dear friend, he and I kind of started together back in summer of 2005, making $31,000 a year. And we, on top of that, you know, we said, how are we going to make more money? You know? And I don't remember how, but we started personal training on the side. And we were able to grow that. Each of us had a steady stream of clients. And we were, you know, we were in the weight room at 5:45 to train our teams. And then we left at 9 o'clock at night, you know, working with our personal training clients. Yet in Indiana, 10 years after the fact, sorry, major liability. We were bringing normal population people in your weight room and training them. So.
Happens in a lot of places.
Yeah. Send a letter to my lawyer. We'll post his address at the end of the podcast, I promise. But you know, that was a side hustle that ended up, you know, quite honestly enabling to pay my bills. And on top of that, it in a really healthy way, it became Tom and I doing the old one-up thing. Well, who's going to get more clients? Who can make more money on the side? And then we started teaching classes at Indiana, and it became, okay, who can withstand teaching more classes? So we had the, you know, we had the double side hustle going there. And transitioning out of Indiana, I went basketball specific, and there's just simply no bandwidth in your day to pull a side hustle while you're working basketball. It just doesn't happen. So
no, that makes total sense. And I think you touched on something that a lot of people overlook in the college setting, is that teaching, right? That's how I funded myself at three different universities, paid for my education, you know, for my master's for one semester before I got a GA in the athletic department. It's definitely something overlooked. If you have that opportunity to teach in Kines or anything else you got your bachelor's or master's in, that's a great way to go for sure. Did you actually enjoy that?
I really enjoy teaching. There were times when I regretted not getting the PhD and doing that full time. I don't regret it now, but I enjoyed it that much that I wouldn't have minded being a professor. So, just to backtrack a little bit, you know, I was able to do some small real estate ventures on the side when I was full-time basketball, but that's obviously something you can make your own schedule for, and it's not, you know, you're not too bogged down by that. So I guess I did have some side stuff going on all the way through until about 20, well, last year when I sold everything off.
So in terms of that, just dig into it a little for us. Were you just, you working with someone? Were you doing it yourself? Were you just putting a little money? Was it something where, you know, 1 week, you know, again, are you a slum lord? Like, what are you? How, what do you mean by doing a little real estate?
I was a one-man shop aside from hiring a property manager to run my property in Bloomington, Indiana. I bought in 07, just pre-crash, and hung on to that for 11 or 12 years, and you know, was able to do some good stuff on the side. Other than that, I, you know, made some land investments that were just a pile of dirt, right? No maintenance or anything required on that. But you know, beyond that, I did, you know, I did all my own taxes. I hired all my own contractors, ran the books myself. So, I mean, Joe, you want to talk about failing? I mean, when you lose track of 4 to 5 figures and then it takes a couple of days to find it, it's like, that's a very good learning experience.
Dive into that, right? I mean, I jokingly started with, you know, where the CFOs and everyone we've talked to has kind of been the same way. Maybe it's a personality flaw or strength because we were strength coaches and whatever. But how did you learn that side? Was it trial and error? That side in terms of the financial side, the X's and O's of dollar math, doing your taxes, you know, same thing. Was it, you had friends who you called on? Was it books? Was it you just did it and then you failed and you got better?
There's a part of me, my first reaction to that question is to tell you that I'm self-taught, but that's a lie. But you know, a lot of it was self-taught. A lot of it was failing forward, but a sizable percentage of it was calling my dad. You know, my father's been in real estate in many different capacities for 40 years. So calling on him for guidance and probably calling him 16 times in one day in the middle of a closing, because I don't know what X, Y, and Z means. So, you know, but that's what you do. You know, you call on people you trust and people that know what you're trying to do. I think that everyone's band of consultants is always closer than they think. So the old man wasn't so dumb.
No, that's a great touch. He's only dumb to about 26, 27. And then he gets really freaking smart once you either like get married or have a kid. Suddenly 100%. That guy knows his stuff. Really weird how there's that transition there.
100%.
Yep. So were you a mistake landlord? Were you somebody who bought the property in Bloomington when y'all were living there or coaching there and then had to rent it out afterwards, couldn't find a way to sell it?
I didn't try to sell it. I had considered selling it, but I got the Ohio job 18 months after I was able to purchase the property. So, I mean, I moved in the thick of the crash, right? Kind of a weird time to try to do a real estate transaction. I considered that. I considered the potential investment. You know, Bloomington's grown at, you know, by dumb luck, I forecasted how much Bloomington would grow 12 years ago, and it did grow. So, you know, the growth paid off, the patience paid off. It was a bad time to sell. And I had my brother actually was living in Bloomington, and he managed the property for about 18 months. And I would just throw him, you know, a case of beer when I saw him, or, you know, send him $100 here and there. So, and then when he finished his doctorate work in Bloomington and moved on, I was able to find a great management company and they managed it for the better part of a decade.
This is something that nobody ever talks about. They never talk about, hey, I got the job offer on Monday, I need to be there within 7 to 10 days. And then I start that next job running. Like, other than having an amazing wife or spouse or partner or whatever you have to take care of stuff like that, this is something that just gets left out. Everybody's like, oh, I jumped in my car, bro, and I drove straight there, and I was coaching the next day because I'm hardcore.
Right.
No, somebody was taking care of it. So going through that is important. What were the steps you went through to find the right property manager for you?
Oh, man, that's a great question. I distinctly remember, Joe, you're going to love this. I distinctly remember reading online reviews. I don't know what the favored forum was in 2009, Angie's List or something. I don't even know if that was around. But I came across, you know, you get your list of 5 to 10 and you do the Google search and you go through a quick review. And this particular woman was reviewed by residents, not by property owners. The residents say, well, she wanted $20 for the blinds being not right, and she wanted this. And they said, she's really hardcore on the residents. I said, that's the woman I want managing my property.
That's an incredibly intelligent way to do that. That is top drawer right there. I like that a lot.
If the tenants that are destroying the place think she's a expletive, she can be in charge of the main investment in my portfolio right now. Have at it.
No, that's incredibly smart, and something that gets overlooked all the time is who's going to take care of it when you're gone. I mean, I own a couple of rental properties, and I got, you know, I've done a few flips now and everything, and that's something I question all the time. I've been doing it myself, but that is going to quickly change because I just don't have the bandwidth to take care of multiple properties at once and having to put people in places and take care of all that for sure. Have you had any downside, anything for people to look out for as they're going through this process if they go through it?
Particularly the real estate?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, there's going to be headaches, right? And the problem is, you know, I'm living in Ohio and I can't drive 6 hours to go see the headache in person. So there's a leap of faith there. You're relying on somebody else to put a fire out for you. And we had not literal fires, thank God. We had the metaphorical fires numerous times over the years. And, you know, God bless my brother. He had to handle it. And you know, you feel bad as a family member asking him to deal with idiots. And then, you know, we switched to the professional management company, and they've got to deal with it. So yeah, if you're a strength coach and you're moving every 18 months and you buy property, you're gonna have to sell it. That's a hassle. You're gonna have to rent it out. That's a hassle. None of what we're discussing is an easy road, right? And sometimes you get lucky and you sit on something for a decade and you make a couple bucks when you sell. Nice. So
I want to jump in and make a point. There was something about thinking ahead. So we were talking about, and Powell, kind of along with what you had mentioned, everyone says, oh, you know, I was hardcore. Like, I have that story. I left on a Tuesday, started coaching on a Thursday. You know, when I left Kansas to go to Hofstra, I left on a Wednesday and started coaching the following Monday. I had 7 days to drive across the country and unpack, right? Sounds cool. It's yeah. But I had 4 months of apartment to pay for that I couldn't.
Oh, yeah.
And I had no one there to take the trash out or to make sure the utilities, you know, make sure nothing leaked or whatever. So I actually ended up, one of the things I always tell everyone is when you're going to make that job transition, think ahead. So me, I knew I was leaving Kansas that year. I didn't know when. So when my lease came up, I actually negotiated a 6-month lease. So when I left in March, my lease was done in July versus December, because I knew that if I got to July and didn't have a job, I probably wasn't getting one until the following year, because I was more Olympic. I did a little bit of primary sport, but I wasn't a football guy and I didn't want to be, and I wasn't a basketball guy at the time, though I got that stigma because of UConn and Kansas. Sure. So I purposely changed my lease because I knew if I was to leave between December and July, I could afford, with my savings and everything else, paying that apartment in this part of the country while getting one over here. So again, that's something I think goes very underlooked. Was the only reason I was able to do that was because I thought about it. It didn't just happen.
The other thing every young strength coach who's not married and doesn't have family should be doing is you should be house hacking in one way or another. When I was living in Louisiana as the head strength coach, single still, that's where I met my wife, thankfully, best investment I've ever made. And so I would have an apartment, had two other bedrooms in it, and those two people paid for everything except for $100 of my rent and utilities combined. You don't have to buy a house to house hack. You can find better ways to make sure you're saving money. And guess what? I sublet it because I knew jobs were coming, and I sublet it before I even got my job and accepted it. I already had it ready to go because I knew things were coming down the pipe.
Yep. No, I hear you. And
that's little, great.
Little things like in the industry, interns. You know, you when you said you left Indiana, you had your brother. Well, when I left Kansas, I had a couple interns, and I said, hey, look, guys, I'll pay you $100 for 3 months, each month, $100 each month. Here's a key. Go there once a month, check everything, make sure nothing's happened, do this, do that, report in. And it was the easiest $300 I ever gave someone because the people I gave it to went more than just once a month. They drove by on their way home. They checked, they peeked in. So I always knew that my place that I was paying for but wasn't at, that God knows what could happen, was at least had a set of eyes on it and relatively cheap. My cheapest property manager was one of my interns.
That's great. Hey, here's another hack I was able to pull off. I just remembered. I drove my personal vehicle to as many away games and away events as possible because I could claim the mileage. And they were paying 65 cents on the mile back then. So there were multiple months where I paid my rent by going to a swim meet at Purdue or something like that. So, you know, again, we're talking to you know, maybe a younger crowd. You know, you've got to be creative. And not just when you're younger, you've got to be creative, you know, throughout all your endeavors, you know, to kind of make things work for you. So I'm pretty sure they're not giving 65 cents on the mile anymore. The economy's not favorable for that, but it was a good pluck for a guy making 30 grand, right?
Nice.
Absolutely. And that's a great point, is like not letting that lifestyle creep kind of catch up to you where you make a little more money as you move up to the next job. And the next job, and the next job. And all that happens is all the bills creep up at that same rate. So your take home is still going to be about the same. And your ability to invest or save or whatever your goal is, for sure. So that's a great point, for sure. So a couple of questions we'd like to ask a lot of people. What is the worst piece of advice you've heard from somebody in the industry to somebody outside of the industry, and vice versa, if you don't mind?
Oh, wow. We might have to do another podcast.
I mean, I'm not turning that down. We can definitely start here and then just work into season two, you know, or episode two, however it goes. We'll see.
Not so much on a personal experience level, but I think that one of the dumbest things that people say is you've got to make your own mistakes. And you do have to make your own mistakes. But if I watch Joe run a red light and he gets a ticket, I don't have to go run the same red light that I know the cop's hanging out at in order to know that that's not what I'm supposed to do. So some examples, you know, that are super obvious, you could probably watch somebody else screw it up and not do it. I'd have to think where to even start on a personal level, though. What's the worst advice I've gotten? There's been some bad stuff out there. So, you know, one really bad piece of advice that I got multiple times, and I'm sure both of you got it, and I'm sure all young people starting out get it. I got this piece of advice from a ton of people, was don't be a strength coach. Yeah, a lot.
I mean, that is good advice.
It is good advice. And gosh, sitting here now, you know, I would say to a lot of young folks, you know, don't become a strength coach when I was on the way out. But I did it. Do I regret doing it? No, because it was an incredible experience, and it was something that I was driven to do, and I craved that experience. So I don't think that was a great piece of advice, you know, just don't do it. So, but maybe they had made the mistake and I was too dumb to see the mistake. So I'm going back on what I said previously about.
You ran the red lies, what you're saying.
Yeah. What about you, Matt? What's some of the worst advice you got along the way?
Man, I think that the biggest thing I've seen is that so many people are so focused on college and pro, they forget some of the other really cool aspects of it. So the tactical side is amazing. NASCAR is another amazing opportunity. Yes. And man, I don't know about y'all, but when I coach normal people, right? So I'll help out at local strongman gyms or powerlifting gyms because those are things that mean a lot to me. So I'll go and I'll help out and I'll coach there. And coaching non-athletic regular people, or NARPs as I call them, or most people call them, is actually what makes you a better coach, right? We were talking about this earlier, where these high-level colleges get these amazing athletes, these 5 stars, these 4 stars, and they're able to take them and make small tweaks. I kind of like that complete overhaul, right? You give me a crappy old Geo Metro, and I'm going to give you the most badass Geo Metro with racing stripes you've ever seen in your entire life. So, I mean, that's really how you hone some of your coaching. So those two things are things that bother me. One, college, NBA, NFL, MLB are not the only things. There are other really cool caveats and parts of the field that people don't step into because of, you know, some sort of stigma about them. And then the other caveat is coaching regular people can make you a way better coach than coaching just great athletes all the time.
It's a great point. Totally agree.
Absolutely.
Joe, you got to tell us the worst advice you ever got. I know you've gotten some along the road here, man.
Yeah, I've gotten some bad ones. In this world, in the coaching kind of side, the worst advice I ever got, and again, I won't use the name, it was a sport coach. It was around committing to the program because as support staff, right, it was my job to be there before it. His advice to me was to be successful in my role. So, you know, as a young kid, I think I was 22, maybe 23, something like that. You know, hey, you seem really smart. You got a great personality. The kids really like you, you know, but I think that for you to be successful, you need to commit to this like it's your family. You need to be here before everyone. You need to be here after everyone. You need to be here and know everything going on, because the only way you can make an impact is if you do that. And being not only who I am in terms of education and other stuff with mentors and stuff, but also just being a smart ass, I kind of looked at him and I was like, but what if that's not my number one priority? And he kind of looked at me, because obviously it didn't register. And he was like, well, then why would you even work here? And that was one of the moments where I knew that I had a shelf life in this industry, because this particular person was not an amazing coach. They, you know, it wasn't Gino Auriemma. It was not someone at that level. But well-known, well-regarded, well-considered. And that's what I knew. I was like, okay, this is to your point you made earlier, this is something I do because I have a passion for it, but it does not define who I am.
It's a great distinction point. Yeah. And that is absolutely horrid advice. I agree with you.
Yeah. It was some of the worst shit I had ever heard.
Joe, I would argue that
it was good advice not to listen, but yes, it was bad advice from a career what to do standpoint.
I think there's a very strong argument that that advice would have made you a worse coach, because if you're there 14 hours instead of 11, how much more run down and beat down are you? Not you. I mean, you have an endless supply of energy. We know that. But I'm talking about everybody else. So,
yeah. No, that's something I've referenced to one of the guys I worked with, who, when I first started at Hofstra, Jimmy Prendergast, amazing strength coach, you know, great father, was able to work with him for a couple of years, a guy who I respect as a human and as a coach. And I used to tell him, I'm like, Jimmy, you're here every day. You're the weights coach. right? And I love you for it. You do a great job. Everyone loves you. Everyone respects you. Everyone knows you're good. And that's why they come. The problem is no one values your time. And he looked at me like I was crazy. And I remember having this conversation. And for the first couple months, I know he didn't really like me. He didn't get me. And he was like, but what? I'm like, because you're always here, you're expected to always be here. And now you've set the boundary that I'll always be here. And it's been very cool watching him transition to where he's at now, where, you know, he doesn't show up to work 1 or 2 days a week when his schedule allows it. So he stays home and eats breakfast with his kids. And again, having children, getting older, you know, getting married, the lifestyle change he had that forced him to have to do some of that because, you know, again, his wife, who's an awesome person, was probably like, be home. So some of that, but that if you have no if you show that you have no respect for your own time, no one's going to have respect for your time. That was one of the biggest things I always tried to impart onto everyone, because again, I saw it as a shelf life problem. You know, if you're there 70 hours, why can't you be there 75? Why aren't you there 75? You know?
Yeah. To your point, I mean, you have to be the one that sets your boundaries and defines your parameters, because no one else is going to do it for you. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's an interesting premise for a conversation. I mean, how far can you put your foot in the sand to protect yourself, so to speak, and keep your job? You know, for a strength and conditioning coach at the collegiate level, I would say that rope is really short, right?
No, so that's actually a perfect transition. One of the questions we asked everybody on is we ask them, what do you do to manage your personal time? And you could talk about now with your job, or you could talk about, you know, back when you're a coach, whatever makes more sense for you to answer. But how do you manage your personal time and keep that kind of balance? Because obviously we all know it's never really a balance.
Never really a balance. You know, the thing that helped me the most during the coaching years was, you know, you get to work out at work, right? So that is my outlet now, has always been my outlet. So, you know, if I could walk out of my office and you know, let loose and blow some steam off for an hour, hour and 15 minutes, you know, that enabled me to get through my day. Outside of that, I think it comes down to kind of managing at a micro level. I mean, there were field hockey games at 2 o'clock on a Sunday that I wasn't required to be at. It would have looked really good if I was there, but I didn't go. You know, so sometimes, again, on a case by case micro level, I just made the decision to kind of take some time for myself. And I, you know, that may sound insignificant, but I think that is significant, because I've seen a lot of young strength coaches that don't even allow themselves to even consider making a decision for themselves along those lines. And we, you know, we've seen it; they burn out in 2 to 3 years. And you know, the life balance outside of collegiate athletics and working in the business world now. Not to be flippant, but it's almost easy now, right? Like 45 hours a week. That's, you know, we can do that in our sleep, right, Matt?
Absolutely, no question about it. Which, yeah. One other thing I want to bring up, you as a head strength coach, I know, you know, when Joe and I were in that role, we talk about it quite a bit. It's about taking care of the people underneath you. And I had a great coach when I was at Call to Charleston. He's with the SEALs now. And he would tell me, hey, get the hell out of here. What are you doing? Remember I came in, it was right around Christmas time. Everybody was off campus. We were done. And I was in there either programming, lifting, or doing both. And he literally said to me, I don't want to see you again until January, whatever day. Do not come back for those days. When I see you in here, I'm going to fire your ass. And at the time I was pissed off. I was like, where am I going to train? What am I going to do? I don't have anything. You know what I mean? And I was in Charleston, South Carolina. So obviously I still got in trouble at night, but it was definitely something about learning that balance that, you know, 24, 25, I didn't understand. And then once I got hired the next year as a head strength coach, it made way more sense.
Yeah. I commend your leader there. I mean, that's incredible. You know, leadership and human compassion, foresight, understanding, you know, what, however many adjectives we want to throw at it. I remember as a graduate student saying, hey, I've got a monster final, you know, can I cut out of, I'll pick on track here, Joe. Can I cut out of the track lift?
It's track.
Can I leave the multis lift 30 minutes early so I can get a jump on studying? And
the most athletic people in the gym, you don't need to watch. It's all, please. And the multi lift, that runs itself, baby. That runs itself.
Amen.
That ain't a thrower's lift and that ain't cross country.
Just hit play, brother. Sit back and let it roll.
The most athletic people in the school.
So Matt, pardon the example there that Joe ran with, but that, you know, and I remember being told as a graduate student, no, you got to stay till the end. We got to clean up. And, you know, after all that, you've got 90 minutes that's been dented into your study time. So I remembered those scenarios and, you know, I'd like to think I had as much of a positive impact on some of the younger people working for me as your mentor did for you. You know, I did make it a point to, you know, kick them out, go study. You know, I had an individual with some bona fide family issues, and I kicked them out for 2 weeks. I said that's way more important than us watching kids lift weights. You know, I you know, as a head strength coach, I remember when my oldest son was born, and you know, you've got, you know, that's a hell of a 72 hours, right? You don't sleep. I mean, that's a monster. And I remember the dust settling from that and getting on the phone with a certain sport coach and them saying, okay, let me tell you everything that got screwed up while you were gone and why I didn't like it. And, you know, we're here X number of years later, and I'm remembering just how awful that was. And, you know, I don't know if inhumane is an appropriate word, but it bordered on inhumane, right? So those things are impactful. I mean, Matt, we're sitting here talking about it however many years after your leader said that to you. And it's a simple 1 to 2 sentences, but you know, it sticks with people, right?
100%.
Yeah. No, we can go down this rabbit hole a lot longer. So yes. You know, we can go back and forth with a lot of stuff. I will give one particular guy credit, right? When I was an intern at UConn and he left to take a job with Cleveland Browns, he gave me a thank you card, right? And it had a little gift card for food because I was a poor intern. But in the card, it said, treat every day like you're new. And that was Matt Powell to me when I was a schmuck and he was trying to impart some wisdom. And I still have the card. It's in my folder of stuff that I save in my career that I haven't looked at it in 20 years, Matt, no offense, but it's in there. I know it's in there.
If you have the gift card, are you taking us to lunch?
No, gift card's long gone. I think that was gone that afternoon.
Fair.
But the point of you really, really, really remember the big things, positive, and then the negative ones because you're like, wow, you're an asshole.
Yeah.
So here, how about this? Along that line, on the positive side, how about the positive investment side? $500 or less, what's the best thing you've ever spent that amount of money or less on for yourself, for business, for education, for whatever it was? Mike pulled the trigger, made the purchase, and it had the best impact.
Oh, wow. I'm going to cheat a little bit on your question, and I gotta up it really, because it ties into what we're talking about. I've got to up the figure to $1,500.
All right.
And I was at Indiana at the time, and I had 4 days to myself, maybe 5. And I got a plane ticket, and I met up with some buddies in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and we hiked Jackson Hole for 3 or 4 days. And that's plane ticket, lodging, food, and everything. Spent the $1,500 when I absolutely did not have $1,500 to spend on anything. And that was something I did for myself. It was a financial leap, and it was an incredible experience on many different levels. So that's, if we can up it to 1,500, that's my answer. The plane ticket might have been 500 though, so you know, that might fall within your parameters.
All right, great. Hey, great answer, man. Great answer.
Thank you. All right, we gonna go around the horn here, Joe. What's yours? I gotta know.
For $500 or less, oof. Best thing I've ever done for myself for $500 or less. You know what? Probably. When I was at Hofstra, I sat down with my wife about 3 months into the job. It was in the summer. I started in March. It was like July-ish. I'm sitting in the backyard in the Jersey Shore with the ocean breeze, drinking a Yingling. I remember this. I can see her, what she was wearing, everything. And I said to her, so I looked into getting another degree. And she gave me that look like, oh, shit, here's your next project. And I was like, it's only like a $49.99 application fee. And she looked at me, and I'll never forget it because, I mean, I love her to death, but like she looked at me and gave me that look like, if you spend $49.99 and don't get this degree, I'll murder you. That was the look. And I remember being like in the back of my head, being like, it's $50. Like, I'll apply, I'll do it, like whatever, like no big deal. But she gave me a look that was both sincere, like, I know you can, but if you piss away $50, I'll kill you. So that was probably the best, because doing that opened more doors. It opened my brain to how to learn better. It opened my network. It from that moment, drinking that beer, saying it out loud and making it tangible,
yeah,
has literally created the world I live in now. So that's got to be it for me.
She kind of reminded me a little bit of the hard-nosed property manager in my earlier story. So if she ever wants to manage my portfolio, if she's that frugal, she can be my CFO. Have her call me, okay?
Yeah, yeah. She didn't even say it. It was the look. It was like,
yeah.
So yeah.
Powell. So, last question we asked everyone.
What's yours? Give me a 500.
You got to hear me.
Yeah, what's your 500, Matt?
So I am notoriously cheap, and I'll be a great property manager for anyone but my own properties. So we're sitting there, we're doing our honeymoon, and we actually did it about a year after because I had an asshole best friend who got married 6 days after me. That guy sucks. So we were going to Punta Cana, and she's like, hey, we can upgrade and get the VIP experience for, I think it was exactly $500. And I was like, I don't know, da 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 da. We show up, we end up doing it. We show up, and there's every single bottle of alcohol in our room. We have VIP. That was by far one of the best weeks of my life. So that was worth every damn cent just to have somebody actually take care of me and us for once. So that was great.
Oh, your story's way better than ours. Damn.
I was going to say, I had to check that because it was an important thing. But as a listener, I'm like, hold on. Why am I not in Punta Cana with a thing? Hell.
Punta Cana, open bar. What are we doing here, huh?
That's what I'm saying. Who wants a podcast with me in Punta Cana? It just makes way more sense.
So, absolutely.
Future sponsors, I think we're going to do this as a Punta Cana getaway where we fly people in. Me and Matt and family stay for about a month. We record every day. Just check and make sure it's in the budget.
Absolutely. It just makes sense. It's a good financial decision for sure.
Shout out to our sponsors at Sandals Resort. Thank you, Sandals, for sponsoring the podcast.
All right, Mike,
We'll get your tourism up. We'll bring strength coaches. Okay. Again, NSCA, LaDonna Reed, have an event somewhere where people can bring their families so then they actually bring their families and enjoy the event because no one's going to your stuff recently anyways, not just because of COVID. So you might as well do it big time. Yep.
All right, Mike, last question for you. Who coaches you and why? I know we kind of talked about this earlier, but do you have a specific coach or somebody who kind of oversees what you do, somebody besides just dad who can, you know, give you life advice?
Well, you know, the big coach that I have right now is the VP that I report to at the current firm, you know, that I work for. I got super lucky. She and I just click. I mean, she's been in the industry for 35, maybe 40 years. Very, very pragmatic, very level-headed, very methodical, doesn't get emotional, praises you when you deserve it, tells you when you screwed up, and just does it in a very honest, direct way. So if she sounds like the type of person that, you know, you would want to be coached by, she is. So, and Gina Gallagher, shout out to Gina Gallagher, awesome VP to work for. She was the one that probably, you know, to her credit, was patient with me through that first 6 month period of failing forward, not knowing the industry, learning a brand new language, you know, for the first 6 to 8 months. So that's my coach right now, man.
All right. So that's it. We got nothing else. We ran out of questions after the big three. You're done.